Are you sitting comfortably? Then we shall begin. Welcome to Stay in the Loop with Lucy, a podcast that is prepared to make us all feel a little uncomfortable occasionally. Today's episode is about a woman's experience with breast cancer, surgery, and reconstruction. Let me introduce you to Michelle. This is no regular conversation with a woman experiencing breast cancer, though, because all I kept hearing all the way through was a sense of joy of what the diagnosis of breast cancer had brought her. I wouldn't have expected to have those two words together in one sentence. I don't want to spoil any of it for you, but I would ask you, if you know a woman who's had a recent diagnosis of breast cancer, then please share this podcast with her, because it could make the difference between feeling a victim to breast cancer and actually embracing the potential of what it has to offer each and every single one of us, both as the experience and supporting someone with breast cancer. The ripple effect of what Michelle has shared could potentially make the difference for someone in their life, in their family's life, in the people who are supporting them in the medical profession's life, about what makes the difference for someone when they are on the receiving end and going through this process of a breast cancer diagnosis. Without further ado, Michelle. Welcome, Michelle. It is so beautiful to finally be able to record this interview with you. We've been talking about it for a while, and it has been very clear all the way through that there is much to share about a woman who has an experience of breast cancer from the start to the middle to the end, and then as a reflection process, being able to consider how they were living, to how they lived, to how they are living, and perhaps the sensitivity, the renewed sensitivity that I have noticed in your body is where we will get to by the end of this interview, that the whole world can feel the Michelle that I know and have sitting in front of me right now. So perhaps we could start with, what was life like before you got that diagnosis of breast cancer?
Yeah, thanks, Lucy. And I love that you've brought up the sensitivity, and I look forward to sharing certainly where how my body feels in relation to that now. Certainly going back, and I'll go back a bit before, so even possibly 10 years or, you know, I've been a parent on my own since my son was born. He's 16 when I was diagnosed, so 17 now. And I guess that's probably throughout that a reflection of this, you know, this, I can do this on my own. I've always had the support of family around me, but I could very much feel in that as a single mother, and I got pregnant overseas. So there's the father has not had any involvement. So this process of being both mother and father, and in that, you know, having to be aware of, you know, really the movements in your body, the level of stress. You know, I can look back to the early years and think about the level of stress that I was under or took on in trying to be everything to this, you know, young boy, this young being, who is in turn very sensitive himself. And as I realize now, was always reflecting that to me while I was kind of barreling through life, so to speak. And if I look back at childhood, and I look back at through school, if I look back at university, there was actually I had an image one day not so long ago, and I grew up in New Zealand. So for those of you that may or may not know, New Zealand's national sport is rugby union. And I actually got an image this day of like literally being a rugby player barreling through life. So, you know, I'd always, even just my physical form, I've got quite broad shoulders. I'm, you know, physically very strong. So this image came to me. I was like, wow, that's actually how I kind of did life. Just, yeah, literally barrel down, shoulders down. You know, I could feel it in my body, that bracing, almost like if anyone's seen the rugby the All Blacks do the haka. Like, seriously, that sense of, I'm going to take the world on. You know, I can do this. So that's kind of what I, in a nutshell, would describe life as being. So I guess I could say I'd move through life kind of just the body got me from A to B. It was, you know, certainly through university, if I think back on, you know, the way I treated my body, what I ingested into it, all of those things, that from where I sit now, I have to call it abuse. You know, there's no denying it. We don't like to do that when we're in the midst of stress and dealing with life. But for me, now I can look back and go, that's abuse. And I'm not saying that that's completely stopped yet by any stretch of, but the sensitivity now in my body says that doesn't feel great anymore. And it's what I've noticed is a much greater sensitivity, not just to the physical, but also to what's going on around me. So I feel like in how I had gone through life, it was pretty much, as I said, that hardened barrel through life kind of happens out there, and the stress and the impact of it, I'm just going to keep doing what I need to do to manage. And that was very much, I think, the case as a single parent.
I'd love to tease out that what was normal in my world, when we use the word abuse, it's something that's very, very serious. You know, it's usually sexual, or now we have finally got to a place in the world where we actually recognize the emotional and psychological and the financial abuse. But for many years, and perhaps for a lot of listeners of this podcast, they would go, oh, you know, physical abuse is, you know, beating someone up or sexually assaulting them or sexually abusing them. What you have described there, and I don't presume to know if you had any of those experiences, but what you have described is more the sensitivity of you barreled through life. You had this, you know, hard exterior. I can do this. I can do this. But what I heard you say was it was the self-abuse, the way that attitude of barreling through life that you recognized was actually really emotionally, psychologically, and therefore physically harming you, Did I pick up that correctly?
Yeah, Lucy, that's spot on. And thank you for bringing it back to self-abuse, because that is, and look, I'll clarify, I haven't experienced any sexual or physical abuse in this life to date. But yeah, the self-abuse. So even as you ask that question again, like, I can feel in my body now that hardening, that barreling through life, the way that, if you think about it, your shoulders would come in and close in, and a lot of women actually and men walk around in that position. That in itself, that movement abuses the delicateness of our bodies. Now, a few years ago, you would never have had me describing myself as delicate. As a child, I was often like, you're like a bull in a china shop. You know, when you run, it's like a herd of elephants running down the hallway. I'm not by physical stature, like a fine, you know, what we might call fine or skinny or thin. But there is now a delicacy and a delicateness registered in my body post breast cancer diagnosis and surgery that has allowed me to go back and say, well, if I'm not feeling that delicateness in my body, then that is self-abuse. What have I gone into? If I'm in any form of self-judgment, which has been, you know, like the devil on my shoulder my whole life, whispering in my ear, no, you're not good enough. You need to do this. You need to do more. If I have altered the openness in my body in any way, then that's self-abuse. If I'm speaking to another harshly, you know, if I'm in reaction, if emotional, for example, when I start to register how that feels in my body, then I'm actually in a movement of self-abuse, not to mention in that case what we are doing to another.
Yes, and I can see by the way you have taken us through that, that as you recognize what that is to you, then you would be far more sensitive to how it comes from another. And if I may offer an example, when, I mean, we're all super sensitive. We just pretend we're not, I reckon. So we can always feel an atmosphere in a room when someone comes in and they're in real tension and you kind of go, ooh, the temperature in this room has just dropped. And there's that sense of, okay, what do I do with that tension? But if I'm in a mood and I speak harshly to someone, I mean, I remember when my kids were very little, my middle child was very clear that that felt like she, it was like I had hit her when I would say stop, or, you know, when I would, there would be something that I would say. And you could see it, the words in her reaction to me, in her response to me, felt much worse than I thought they were. Whereas to her, because she was so delicately sensitive, she reacted, I mean, well, she showed me basically the harshness of the way I was speaking that I had no concept about. And my sense is when you start developing that in your body, as you have done, that's the level of honesty you start getting to, that to you with you and how you speak to you, that you've taken as normal, but also then you get a bit more sensitive to the way others speak to you. And you know, I would hazard a guess. I mean, personally, I just burst into tears when someone would speak to me harshly, and I would question, you know, what am I doing? Relax, calm down, toughen up, Lucy. But you can't do that, can you, when you are sick or when you get into a space where you're more vulnerable? That guarding is not, it cannot be there.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, you just said one of those key phrases that we throw around all the time, toughen up, you know, and you're weak if you cry. And look, probably that toughen up and protection is how I would have gone through life. Again, anyone speaking harshly to me or loud, or I can look back and see that that's what I did. And even that now feels like that's another form of self-abuse in a way, to withdraw, to protect, to harden. Anything that hardens, you know, this body, and I share from my own experience, is against what I now can feel is a natural way of being. Our body is incredibly sensitive to everything that's happening around us. And as I shared, I guess my son in some ways has been a very major reflection of that over the last few years. Again, he is super sensitive, and he has pulled me up again throughout that time. And he would come home from school, for example, and talk about teachers with raised voices. It would just literally, you know, kind of shatter his world. I think through much of that, I was still very much in the, you know, I've got a parent, I've got to get you fed, I've got to work, I've got to, you know, put a roof over our heads. So all of those sort of movements, all of that, hardening of the body, the protection, the drive is, you know, an element of drive. I've got to work. You know, I love to work, but work was very much then, you know, I've got to make sure I've got a job, I've got to be working, I've got to practically, and that's true, put a roof over a table. But there was a way of working that was very, I use the word functional, and there is an element of that. But what I've discovered post diagnosis and surgery is there's a richness to work that I wasn't at all connected to. It was just, I go to work, I come home, I get dinner, we do that, go to bed, get up again the next day. Like, life has definitely had that
function.
function,
It's a
mundaneness.
cold word, isn't it? It's function.
It's function. And, you know, I've worked in sort of health promotion and public health type research for a number of years. So a lot of that time has been around, you know, lifestyle change, behavior change. How do we get, how can we support people to take better care of their bodies? And, you know, when we move in that function, there seems to be very, in all honesty, little appreciation for what our bodies can actually truly offer us. It's just a movement from A to B, B to C, C to D, you know, bed to the coffee machine in the morning, or what, you know, whatever cycles you're in your day.
So
And
let's go to that diagnosis. What happened?
so this was at the beginning of last year, 2022. So I'd noticed not a lump per se, but a lumpiness in my left breast in an area. And I'd probably been sort of putting it off for a couple of months, going, you know, I've got to go and get this seen too, as we do in our busy lives. And eventually it was like, okay, I need to go and get this checked out. So I had been to breast screen in the past just for mammograms. So I just booked in to see them again and went through the basic, went and had a mammogram as the first step. I got a call back from them. Wasn't very long after, and then went back for a day of tests, further scans. And it's like, oh, we need to do an ultrasound. At which point it was pretty obvious to me that there was something going on, and we want you to. The surgeon happens to be here today. We just want him to have a look. We'll do biopsy. So the whole day, and I will mention this because this day was quite significant in that. So early 2022, we were still in Queensland anyway, in kind of COVID restrictions. So you couldn't take anyone else with you to the clinic. You could only be there on your own. Now that's potentially pretty stressful on a day when you are there. And look, I was very aware of, you know, a level of tension in my body about what it might be, but at the same time, just, you know, holding, just breathing gently, just being as still as I could, just feeling in my body. You know, that delicateness, just breathing. There were not a lot of women there on the day, and the staff were incredible. So I remember when I got to the fine needle biopsy, which, you know, it's not a pleasant experience. They, of course, numb the area, but then however many samples had to be taken. But I remember by the time I got there, and I had a friend on standby on the phone. So I did make sure there was support. So I couldn't have anyone with me. My son and my parents knew where I was, so I was updating them on the phone because they were, my son in particular was pretty stressed. But I made sure I had a friend who was available on the phone throughout that day. And so I touched base with her, and I went out and walked around the rose garden at some point because there was a space between appointments. And I feel like I'd already, in some sense, just accepted that there's something going on here. You know, the doctors were very open about that, actually. It was amazing. So in her openness, it was like, okay, just move with what's on offer. There was no, yeah, there was no anxiety or fear, that I felt super strongly. Like, yes, there were definitely some tears. But as I walked and as I breathed, by the time I got to that fine needle biopsy, I remember them commenting. They said to me, "We have never felt anyone so still during this." And there was a sense for me that that was supporting not only me, but them. It's like, if I could be super still and just keep breathing gently and being with my body rather than potentially going, I don't want to be here. I don't want this to be the case. It supported them to do their jobs as well. Yeah, there was just something in me.
I just want to highlight that what you were able to do is actually unusual and say that that's pretty cool based on the support that you set yourself up with right at the beginning to be able to have in the day, even though you were on your own. That to me feels like the bit that says, whatever happens, I know it's going to be okay. I know I've got this, and people have got me, and my supports around me have got me. That it wasn't about a simple physical body and you being on your own, and as you, the momentum that you'd set up from your previous, I've got to do this on my own. It feels like that was being addressed in this moment where you didn't go to do it on your own at all. And as a result, we're very steady. And as a result, that was pointed out by the practitioners who were feeling for you, but also expecting you to, I mean, you know, that they see a lot of women. So their expectation would have been that there would be a certain anxiousness in your body. But because you felt that support, that anxiousness wasn't in your body. Which, my gosh, that's a science experiment in itself to me. Like, I'm blown away by what you're sharing. Wow.
Yeah. It was quite extraordinary to experience. It wasn't, again, it wasn't necessarily what I expected either, but that's also something I've learned. It's like, don't have any expectations about what each interaction is going to look like with a medical professional through this. Like, it's going to be different for all of us. And when you look, my mother had a breast cancer diagnosis a couple of years before me, and the first breast cancer diagnosis in our family, indeed in my kind of circle of friends as well, which is almost unheard of these days. But, you know, what happens when a woman gets a breast cancer diagnosis is there are a lot of pictures and expectations, and there are a lot of thoughts and fears and anxieties. I watched my son, when his grandmother was diagnosed, come up with all these questions, and some of them it was like, wow, where did you even hear that? Like, where did that even come from? You've never experienced this before, and yet, you know, how did it happen? She didn't deserve this. And I remember, you know, my mum, why me? And so there's a lot that comes, for me, it felt at me as, you know, there's a lot that comes at you when you receive a diagnosis. And even that day when I was having all the tests, as I said, it was very evident by about halfway through that test, you know, that there was something there. You know, these are medical experts. They know what they're looking at. You said they look at hundreds of these every month, whatever. And there was just a sense again that I couldn't go, even at that point, if I had hardened my body and gone into any sort of like major fear, major, I don't want it to be this way. And there was some of that. Of course there were. This is it's a change, and it's also an opportunity to reflect on how I had been living. I'm very clear in sort of my philosophy on health and my body and moving, that these things don't just happen, no reason. But I'm also, I know that there's a deeper level of why they happen. It's not just about what we call lifestyle. And so that steadiness wasn't about protecting myself. It was like an acceptance, like, okay, this is happening. How do I best support, this body? How do I support those around me? But primarily, in some ways you could say this was, some ways it might be seen that this was the most selfish move I'd ever made. How do I support me? But this was truly one of those cases, like on the aeroplane, where they say, put your oxygen mask on first so you can, you know, support anyone else. it was very clear that this was about supporting myself, supporting my body. And if I go back to then your question about how I lived my life beforehand, then life had been to some extent about me. I've got to work, I've got to earn money, I want to go on holidays, I want to. But it had also been about others, particularly once you become a mum, you know, how easy it is to make everything about your children. And I imagine that's potentially the same if you get married. I've not been married, you know, had relationships, you know, you make everything about looking after everyone else. And this has been an incredible opportunity to feel what it's truly like to, I'm going to say, put yourself first, but it's putting your body first.
I've got a picture of, you've got a cup of water and you just, watering everyone and everything out of your cup of water and just kind of just making sure as you go to work that you just got enough like to hand it all out. And then this moment has arrived for you and you've gone, okay, you need to find your water elsewhere. Right now, I'm just going to fill up my cup and I'm going to make sure that it's full. And from there, I know that I can do everything that I'm called to do, because you've already mentioned that work has become richer and that your relationships have become richer. It feels to me that you realized that filling that cup up, that we class that as selfish, but actually that's what we should be doing. And how amazing is it to do that for everybody else? So where you have done it on your own before for others, as in water the world, now you're bringing that nourishment to yourself first so that you can be of service in that way to wherever it's called to be.
Yeah, and it was really beautiful to realize too that that watering or nourishing is the word that comes of myself was also about asking. In fact, there were very few that I had to ask. People just said, oh, I was sharing with a friend what was happening because we were supposed to be having dinner one night to catch up. And I said, look, I'm at a clinic at the hospital. I'm not going to be able to, you know, make it. And she said, I'm actually working. She said, is everything okay? I went, oh, I'm actually just here seeing the breast surgeon. I've got a breast cancer diagnosis. And she said, well, let me know if I can ever come to any appointments. And so it was like, okay, I will. Right. And then, you know, a couple of others, you know, so sharing, it's like, yes, I can be there. Just let me know. I will be there. And I could feel that little old voice of going, I didn't want to be an inconvenience. But I was like, we know.
I love
And
what you share because so many people on the outside of a diagnosis wonder how they can be supported and actually are so willing to, to just do what they can do. When you've got a team, then gosh, amazing. May I ask how the importance of having someone at an appointment with you on a practical level? It's not just for the support of you, or it is, but in what way did they bring that support?
yeah. So I remember even the appointment I had for the to get the diagnosis. And it was interesting because the testing happened a week before we were due to go, my son and I, for a trip to Sydney. And they were saying, oh, it'll take this long. I said, well, we're not cancelling our trip. So they managed to make an appointment, slot me in. And again, a friend was able to come up. She said, I will just clear everything. I will be there with you at that appointment. And what's amazing, what I felt in that, like I'd already accepted that there was a cancer, there was cancer there. So in a way, the diagnosis wasn't a surprise. And I think the doctor though was absolutely astounded as we both sat there in with no kind of fear or anxiety, because that's what I could feel as well from my friend who came with me. It was like, okay, what's it? And she asked some different questions than I would have asked as well, which was fabulous. And I found that the whole way through, that having someone there with you, preferably if you've got someone who's a little kind of used to the medical system, who's not intimidated by the system, because it can be very overpowering. I watched my parents, when my mum was diagnosed, feel quite overwhelmed by it all, until they asked me to go to an appointment with them. I offered. I said, "If you want me to come with you, I will come with you." So I then went. As I said, having worked in sort of public health, health promotion research, around medical stuff, I'm not fazed by it, but a lot of people are, and it is overwhelming. As I said, what comes at you, and what you're feeling, it's very, I would say it's essential to have someone with you. But I would add to that, preferably someone who, again, can be detached is not the word, but it kind of is. It's someone who's there with you, but they're not. I notice there's a lot of sympathy can come in around this, and I made it very clear, even to my family, I'm not interested in sympathy. There's nothing to be sorry about. There's nothing. It's like, it's not needed. So all those appointments, even the doctors come at you with sympathy. "Oh, I'm sorry you've got this diagnosis." I'm like, "It's okay. What are we doing? Like, what? Tell me how do we need to approach this? What's happening?" So having someone there who, yeah, is not intimidated by the system.
And it sounds like they are able. So again, you were quite relaxed, but I've heard that people who are more anxious about their diagnosis actually stop hearing a little bit like a deer in the headlights. They think they're hearing, but afterwards they go, "I just don't remember anything that was said." So, having someone in the room who is not emotionally invested with you actually means that they can hear things, perhaps even write notes, so that in the moment there is an understanding of what actually happened and what was said and what's the practical way forward. So makes it as you sound like you were able to say, "Please don't, I don't need the sympathy, but I do need to know what the next steps are." And clearly the nurses and doctors on the first appointment, their directness was really helpful to you. So it's almost for the practitioners involved in this, read your client, figure out actually, do they need it direct? Do you need to ask them to bring someone with you and to make notes and, maybe to direct this process so that the person, the patient's nervous system can go, "I'm fully supported here. I know what's going to happen." And then everyone just goes, "Okay, let's go."
And I should note too that I went through the public system here, so in Brisbane, one of the public systems, so not private. Yeah, I remember one appointment. One of my friends came, and she asked the doctor if she could record it. Can't remember if he said yes or no. I think he maybe no, but she actually just for the nature of her, she had her laptop with her, and she said, "Okay, so do you mind if I take notes?" So she took notes, and she later sent those to me. So, yeah, those appointments also potential, particularly in the public system, they're not lengthy. So a lot can be covered in a short period of time. And yes, if you are feeling anxious or you're not, as I said, my parents were in their 70s. I mean, they're not silly, but an era where doctors were kind of king and know everything. And you're just used to sort of sit there and listen. So it can be quite confronting. What questions do I ask? But also, what was so that support at the appointments was absolutely key. But also, what happened when I first got a diagnosis, I sort of reached out to, I started asking some friends, like, "Who do you know who's had breast cancer?" Who, and it became evident after seeing the surgeon because of the type of breast cancer it was that I would be having a mastectomy. At this point, it was just a single mastectomy. Upon some further testing and MRIs in hospital, a different type of breast cancer was found in the right breast. So it was just, for me, it was like, let's double mastectomy. Let's just, keep it. I know there was part of me just keep it clean. If I keep my right breast, you are definitely going to want to be doing chemo and radiotherapy, and let's just do that. But I started asking if, did you know anyone who's had breast cancer and had surgery? And so I was able to speak to a couple of other women beforehand, which was also invaluable. While all our experiences are different, there were just, key things that I kind of took then to appointments. And one of them that was key was that at the end of my first appointment with the actual breast surgeon, so we talked about the different cancers, having to have a mastectomy. And then we got to the end of it, and I had to ask him, well, what about reconstruction? So I would not have potentially even asked about that had this not come from a conversation with again, with another woman who'd had a mastectomy and said, ask about reconstruction and ask about getting it done immediately. So it's very invaluable to reach out to other women or to the breast cancer network. You can speak to different women and experts. Like it's that point about not isolating yourself. Make use of what's there. So I said the surgeon didn't mention reconstruction. Because what happens is the breast surgeons, they deal with the mastectomy. Then you have to actually talk to plastic surgery about what comes next. Now, again, I didn't know that. Who would know that when they go in? So,
Is that what you ended up doing then? You had two teams, and while you were under anesthetic once, they dealt with the mastectomy, and then another team came in to reconstruct all under the one surgery.
Yes, that is what ended up happening. It wasn't evident initially that it would. Again, as I said, 2022, although we weren't in the midst of COVID pandemics, the impact on the public hospital system, on surgeries, theatre times, everything. I'd been waiting for a plastic surgery consult for about 5 or 6 weeks. It was very evident that we couldn't delay the mastectomy because of the type of cancer in the left breast. So it was like, okay, we're doing this. Hadn't heard from plastic surgery. Again, and another level of accept, had to accept that, all right, well, maybe I'm not going to have a reconstruction immediately. And in the public system currently, you're then looking at a 2 to 3 year wait for reconstruction. And yeah, I did a bit of research online. I'm a researcher by background, so it's kind of the space I've. Again, I didn't go overboard, but it's like, okay, this mastectomy has to happen. This is part of nurturing this body, is there's something here that doesn't belong. And this is the medical advice. And I could feel that that's what was true. So signed off consent. But then a couple of days later, I actually got a call from plastic surgery department saying, we've got an appointment for you like the following week. I met with the surgical registrar and the surgeon. They were like, yeah, you are a candidate. A type of reconstruction I had never heard of. So women may be most familiar with implants. So you can, of course, have implants. But there's also another procedure that's been around for decades called they call it a flap reconstruction. It's a weird name, but where they actually take fat from another part of your body, in my case, the abdomen, and they move that, and that becomes your breasts. Again, I was just like, medicine amazes me, like
Yeah.
that we can do things like that. Like,
Amazing.
it's amazing. So they agreed that I was a suitable candidate. So I was 50. How old was I when I? I must be 52 when I had the diagnosis. And yeah, look, I don't smoke, I don't drink alcohol. Both things which would have made them, consider whether they can do it because it's major surgery on two parts of the body. So they agreed that I was a suitable candidate. I kind of listened, I felt into it all and went, I said, yes, okay, let's do this. I will say I'm pretty sure I had no idea what I was getting myself in for, in truth, but it was a yes. My body just went, yes, well, let's go with this. So anyway, they were able to arrange that surgery actually within about 5 days of me seeing the surgeon for the second time, which I just...
Okay.
So there was another part of this too that, like, I was in the public system and they do their best to work quickly with breast cancer. But it was literally 2 months from the day of diagnosis to the day of surgery. So in some ways I can feel as well, there wasn't a lot of space to have anything but what I just called accept and surrender. Like, this is happening. And so what I could feel is the less anxious I could be, then that supports my body to be set, you know, to be settled with what turned into this massive surgery.
Can I clarify? Accept and surrender to the process, but there is not one part of you, having listened to the way you spoke through it, that gave up, gave in, or handed over. You sound like you were fully engaged at every step of the way. So that word surrender is to a trust that you are held, that you have done, you have done your due diligence. You feel you are very connected with what's going to happen, but it actually feels like you've surrendered to the flow of the process being fully held.
Absolutely. And throughout that time, as I said, we had a trip to Sydney, which we went on. The day I saw the surgeon and he confirmed, yes, we can do this, that afternoon we were actually had planned again a four-night trip just a couple of hours south to be with friends and so came home on the Sunday, surgery on the Monday. There was a part of me that very clearly through all of this, and not in a hard way, because I don't want it, because that's what I didn't want to do, they said, this does not get to rule my life. This does not get to determine, you know, my next movements in terms of, you know, living in fear, et cetera. It's like, yeah, and you know, I was working, so I worked throughout with appointments taken. And look, there was a certain amount of stress because I was on a casual contract, so I won't lie about that. In fact, the day I was at breast cancer having testing, I remember when she said, when it was obvious, the thing that upset me, the thing that actually brought me to tears, and I still think this is kind of crazy, was I'm on a casual contract. I'm not going to get paid. So in...
Yeah, it's horrific. Casual contracts are becoming more and more common, and it's horrific, the abuse of that system.
So that was, so in some ways, that was actually the biggest stress underpinning this whole thing. My workplace were incredibly supportive, but there was a reality. And but again, there was part of me just had to go, I have to not let that either bring on the anxiousness, bring on the any unsettlement in my body, because that's not going to support through this, you know, this surgery. By the time I grasped what this surgery was, 10, 11 hours of surgery, it was just really clear that everything then had to be about supporting my body to be settled with that, to be steady.
Okay, post-surgery, what was that process like?
I know this may sound very strange, but even today, so surgery was end of May, so we're over 12 months past. It has been one of the most joyful and the word phenomenal comes to me, because from waking up with and not li literally not being able to move, and having to learn to sort of walk again, because for 6 weeks, because of the abdominal surgery, and you have to be hunched over. You can't straighten up. You can't walk properly. You can't. You also, because of the mastectomy and work on your chest, your lungs, your breathing properly. But it was such an incredible opportunity to connect even deeper with my body, with how it breathes, with how it moves, with the delicateness that is actually naturally there. So my body knows how to breathe. My body knows how to walk. And I was in hospital for 9 days. And look, for me, that was an incredible experience of both letting go, but also connecting with the staff. Interestingly, because you asked me a bit about the lifestyle and how I went through life beforehand, so I was in a ward with other women, having all sorts of different, it wasn't a cancer ward per se, a surgical ward. And it was interesting just to observe and overhear conversations, because people would be talking to their husbands or their families. And so regardless of what surgery or what had been going on, what I could feel is they were still very much engaged in life. They were still looking after others. They were still very much pulled into family dramas. And, for me, I mean, in one way, there was my body was saying, you just can't do that. You are here to rest, to surrender. I mean, I couldn't even wipe my own bum. that's the moments you talk about support. It's like, oh.
Yeah. We forget how much you have to twist to do something like that.
Exactly. And it was weeks after surgery before I could do that for myself at home. So, yeah, you learn about all the disability aids and things you can use to wipe your bum, and they're great. They work. Fabulous. But, to be there in this ward, and, surrounded by, friends who are coming in to visit, but to be just deeply surrendered to the process that was happening in my body, to allow the nursing staff and the medical staff to do everything that they needed to respond to that. I wasn't fighting that. It was like, okay, this is what's happening. I've got 4 drains in my body, stuff coming. You wake up with a catheter. There are these things that have to happen. And again, the more settled I was with all of that. And I had an amazing time connecting with all the staff. Like, seriously, I found the 9 days in hospital. Towards the end, I could feel I was ready to get out. Again, it was like, oh, it's noisy. I'm not sleeping. My body's ready for being at home. And at home, it was the same, having calling and support. My parents lived downstairs, so Mum was able to help with showers when I was ready to get in a shower, and buying a seat to sit down in the shower. So even though they're little things, it's all about listening to what your body actually is calling for. And that's part of that sensitivity now. Like, if you'd told me, I would have actually got a seat to sit down in the shower, and to do that for as long as my body needed it, while showering. I can't remember how long that lasted, and there was a point where I went, God, you know what? It actually feels really nice to sit down in the shower. Like, why do we not do this?
That's just such a beautiful example of how we can prepare before surgery for post-surgery, and those little things that you deeply appreciate about your body when you go through a physical procedure, that you start bizarrely appreciating what your body does day in, day out, in our normal day-to-day routines and we take completely for granted. You know, lifting your foot off the ground, standing up straight, breathing in and out, twisting to wipe our bums, actually even being able to go to the loo, because post-anesthetic, that's, you know, a challenge in itself. Getting to a shower, lifting up the head of the shower so that you don't stretch your tummy muscles. You
In
know,
my case, I couldn't lift my
couldn't.
arms up. I had to
No.
buy, and look, there's a lot of practical stuff. You know, you have to buy button-through shirts when you've had, and look, the breast care nurses, there's incredible support around that. There were some things about the plastic surgery, the abdominal area, that weren't necessarily so well explained. They don't have, plastic surgery nurses to support with that, and the sort of recovery from the abdominal work is still in progress. And again, I have an amazing physio who's supporting with that. But yes, as you said, even what it takes to get out of bed, what it takes to move your body when you can't use your arms fully, and just the whole way through this deepening appreciation of the body. It is what gets us from A to B during the day. But what's become clear to me is, like, how am I getting from A to B during the day? And the pains and niggles are not to be ignored. They're not to be completely, like, take you out either. That was something I learned as well during recovery. It's like, okay, yes, I've got to do my stretches and movements, because it's really important to rebuild that in the body, the flexibility in the movement. And again, with support from the physio, both at the hospital and my own physio, for whatever reason, I haven't ended up with lymphedema, which is very common for women post breast cancer. In the end, I opted not to have chemo and radiotherapy. And I'm settled with that for me, because what happened as well post-surgery was, I think at about 7 or 8 weeks in, I got offered a new job. So I actually started a new full-time job 10 weeks post-surgery. So there's just something through this whole process, if we're accepting of it, and drawing on all the support that is on offer, and asking for support. I don't know, to me, it was just like, I would not have seen that coming, nor would I have seen that at the 12-month post-surgery mark. And because I've been writing throughout this time, so at some point there will be a book, is that the anniversary of surgery, I actually wrote that I feel more connected to my breasts now than I ever did before surgery.
Stunning. What is so apparent is what can be heard in your voice, the joy, which is unusual and yet so completely normal. You just a summary to summarize slightly what has been shared by you. I made a note that you said these things don't just happen. There is a deeper reason for why they happen, which was before. And then afterwards, you speak about your learning post is that it's not just about going from A to B, but how you go from A to B. The why and then the how feel like it's bought a bit of a circle, a cycle that will forever repeat for you in a way that is really connecting you to your body so that you move, never completely leaving that why and how.
Yeah, I would, yes. And it's beautiful to feel the sensitivity of our body and the delicateness. And perhaps that is part of that, you said, that joy, that connection to my breast is in fact through that, the mastectomy, in my case, mastectomy. To me, it's like there was something in the body that was false, that momentum, that movement of barreling through life. The hardening, it's like there's a poison in the body, and the cancer, the tumor, in my case, whatever type of, it wasn't a lump per se, particular cancer that's like a little cobweb really. It's like, in a way, it's like the body in its wisdom, because our body just, it has a wisdom, it knows what's needed for it, says enough. And it does. It's what it feels like to be feeling the lightness in my body now, the delicateness, the sensitivity, the joy. As you said, the joy is because something's been removed that was no longer suitable. It's not about needed. It was no longer true for this body to move in that way. And while I wouldn't necessarily, well, yeah, it's not true in this body anymore.
So I don't know if I can, if I, it, please tell me if I word this incorrectly for you. It feels like what was removed was momentum that was no longer resonating with the body that you now have. So it is a completely different feel in your body because actually your movement is true to where you are now rather than what you lived then, which was the barreling through life.
Yeah, the exactly. So it's like something was there. It's kind of like it gets all gathered into this, in this case, the breasts. I mean, it could easily have been ovaries, could have been anything. It gets gathered together, and in this case, removed through mastectomy. I mean, equally with breast cancers, it could be through chemo or radiotherapy, and it allows a deepening into what is truly held in our bodies, which is sensitivity and delicateness.
So that's what I really wanted to come back to, because you said at the beginning, I'm going to come back to that delicacy. The sensitivity and delicacy has to be something that is chosen as a strength, because it sounds like that is what's going to be an early warning signal to you that that you potentially could go back to another version of normal. So, I don't know if your life is anything like mine, but I can make all these plans, and health promotion often talks about it, in the cycle of change. You make all these plans, you look after yourself, and then slowly, slowly, you just drop one of them, just drop two of them. Maybe I don't call on that friend, or maybe I'll just do this by myself. And all of a sudden, you're back in a cycle. It's like the frog in the water. You don't notice the temperature going up because it's gone up so incrementally that it's little things. Little bits of, oh, yes, that really hurt when they said that to me, or I've actually been really harsh to that person, but it's fine, it's fine. They understand. Whereas actually, no, those moments all become very significant now because your body has given you the opportunity to be delicate and sensitive enough to notice what was actually harming your body right at the start. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, no, that's a great like observation as well. So those things become more apparent. And it's not to say it's like your body sets off the alarms quicker. I don't know if that makes sense. That's what I get. It's like, hang on, what's happened? I know there was an example recently. Oh, actually this relates to this is post-surgery. So what I've also noticed, even on a physical level, so my shoulders and my neck, get less sore than they ever did. And I work at a computer all day, so we know this. And I just connected, quite recently with really quite an incredible fluidity and ease in my body. And, having had neck and shoulder aches and pains for, well, I've worked in front of a computer for, 30 odd years. And I was like, wow. So again, there's two things that I can be aware of. So if there is a tension in my body, that's an immediate sort of like, okay, how have I been moving? Or what's happened? Have I gone into hardness and why? But the other thing I noticed was really standing out was the abdominal area, the sort of side of pain. Now, look, there's still numbness in that area, but it was like there was a part of my body where there was still this sort of tension and hardness and tightness. And the surgeons, of course, said that's perfectly normal, and it is. It's don't underestimate what's been done in that area. And I've got two layers of mesh in there, together. So the body's kind of got to integrate all that. The nerves are still coming in. I mean, but it stood out to me. And then I've been working with my physio over the last, couple of months to support that area. And something that's made a big change is understanding that probably what I've been doing is some sense of trying to hold it in, trying to rebuild the muscles and holding in and holding on. And by the end of the day, they were actually muscles were tired, and I would be getting this tight, heavy feeling. And she's brought it back to me and said, well, you've actually got to let that go. And it to me, it feels like almost a completion of this full process. Like, what did I do when they said you've got breast cancer? In one respect, I let go. I let go of any pictures. I let go of any fear. I let go of any. It was like, I don't know what this is going to look like, but this is what's presented right in front of me, and this is what I now have to attend to. And so I've come 15 months or whatever it is post-surgery, and she's now telling me the key to this healing in your abdomen, in this abdominal area, is to keep letting go. You have to let the muscles let go. And since my last session with her, and I've been, you're focusing on that, but I've been feeling what it is to let go. It's changed incredibly. But what that brings me to as well is back to that earlier movements in life of hardness and protection. And as women, what I'm actually registering in my own body, and even though she shared this with me, is how much we hold in our abdomen. We protect the slightest threat, the slightest, which can be anything. We all often we'll protect, we'll pull our muscles in and our tummies, and not to mention the fact that we want flat tummies and that whole thing that we're fed. But this is, this is still very much unfolding for me, but it has been like a revelation after this abdominal surgery. And I'm sure other types of plastic surgeries and things on the tummy lead to sensations like what I've experienced, the tightness, the tension. But letting go, it seems to be what all of us, that let go of the past momentums, let go of the hardness, let go of the way that we've moved through life. Let go of picture of having a flat tummy in this is or whatever it is. Let go. And let the body guide us. And I remember when I went for my first walk outside, and I know I've written about this, and I didn't re-look at it this morning, but it was like, okay, I can sort of stand up straight, I can get down the stairs now. I didn't walk very far. But what I felt, I'll never forget, was to feel how delicately I can walk on the earth, how delicately I can move, how my hips work with my spine, with the chest. Like walking is a whole body movement. I don't know, it landed. It was like, wow. my whole body has been offered this incredible opportunity to move differently. I hear, like, I use the word healing, but opportunity to, yeah, how does it feel when my feet touch the ground? How are my hips feelings? How are my shoulders? You know, it's like, oh, yeah, my shoulders. How do they move? So it's been this exquisite adventure. And I do mean exquisite, to come back to how my body moves, even, yeah.
Thank you so much, Michelle. That is, you've taken us on an adventure from the start to the present. And it just feels like the movements, continue from here. Thank you for sharing as much as you have with us today.
Oh, Lucy, it's an absolute joy. As women, there is so much that comes at us that tells us how we have to be, how we have to move. And then you get a breast cancer diagnosis, for example, or probably ovarian cancer. And then we're told even more how we have to be in that process, in that system. And, you know, walking through that system over the last 15 months, and it will continue. There's annual appointments. There's, you know, I've said yes to everything, to meeting the oncologist, to discussing chemo, to having genetic testing done. But we can do that from our own truth, from our body. And it's deeply joyful, or it can be deeply joyful when we let go. And there's no fight. We don't have to fight against the system. We don't have to fight breast cancer. I don't know if it's going to come back or not in this lifetime, but I'm not going to hand over the rest of my life either to any sense of fear or fight or achievement that I beat breast cancer. There's never been an ounce of that in me. It's more surrender to the body. Surrender to what it is here to show me.
Perfect way to end. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you, Lucy.